Have you ever played paintball?
No, I've played laser tag. That's the closest I've come
to paintball. Because I can bond with my friends by talking to them and not shooting
okay,
them.
Okay, don't be. What? What? You know, that's not.
Doesn't talking get old after a while?
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and for the first time since 1975, a congressional district is going to redo its election. So the North Carolina Board of Elections voted unanimously last Thursday to hold a new election in the state's 9th district, and that's after they heard evidence of an illegal absentee ballot scheme. We're going to get into what happened and what we can expect from a redo, and we're also going to talk about the possibility of a primary challenge to President Trump and what kind of challengers should worry him. So here with me to do that are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
It's going well, Galen.
I think that was a full sentence.
Unless you're from North Dakota. In which case, Micah Cohen hates your guts.
Not indulging that. Senior politics writer, Claire Malone. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Galen?
How was your weekend?
Bitten.
All right. And
I don't know if you bleep that or not.
Listeners are definitely going to just hear a bleep. And managing editor, Micah Cohen. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is 530 elections analyst, Nathaniel Rakich. Hey, Nathaniel. How's it going?
Hey, it's going well.
Nathaniel spent the last week following the North Carolina Board of Elections hearing and is going to give us the lowdown on that. Also, later in the show, we're going to play a round of Guess What Americans Think. I'll give the crew a polling question, and they have to guess how Americans responded. Also, before we get going, we have an announcement to make. We have a live show in New York City on March 20th at the NYU Skirball Center, and people can go to 538.com/live to get tickets. I think one of the biggest benefits of this live show is that people are going to be able to hear all of the crazy things Micah says that we have to cut out.
I'm on much better behavior during a live show, so for
no
that
swearing.
Reason. No, I'll swear a little bit, I think, just to keep the consistency there.
All right, go to 538.com/live for more information about that. But let's begin with the election redo in North Carolina's 9th district. So, Nathaniel, we know now that there will be another election. What details did we learn at last week's hearing that pushed the board to call for a new vote?
So we learned a lot of stuff, most of which we had already heard before, but it was still very dramatic to hear witnesses come out and say it. And it was also notable for the witnesses who actually testified against the Mark Harris campaign, who's the Republican for whom a campaign operative was accused of absentee ballot fraud. But we heard from witnesses who actually say they collected absentee ballots from voters, which is illegal in North Carolina. We heard one who admitted to filling out the bubbles for Republicans when they received an unsealed ballot that had some races unvoted. We also heard about some stuff that was flying under the radar a little bit, including the fact that there was apparently a Democratic-aligned PAC that has also been collecting people's ballots in Bladen County, North Carolina, for the last couple of election cycles. And we also heard that the Bladen County Elections Office itself may not have been secure, that election workers looked at the election results from early voting before Election Day, which is a big no-no, and that they hung the keys to the room where they stored the ballots in a public place. So there was a lot that went on, and ultimately that caused the board, which is a bipartisan board, 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans, to vote to hold a new election. But the kind of the thing that tipped it over was the testimony of Mark Harris, the Republican candidate himself, and of his son. And that was probably the most dramatic moment of the hearing.
Yeah, what did they have to say?
John Harris is an adult attorney in North Carolina, the son, and Mark Harris is the father, the candidate. But John is actually working for an office that has been investigating this race and kind of a different track. And he took the stand on Wednesday of this hearing in what was a surprise to everybody. And he produced emails that showed that he had warned his father that he believed that illegal things were going on in Bladen County. So the operative who is accused of running this absentee ballot scheme first did it in 2016. John Harris, again, the son, noticed this. He was playing around with the numbers in Excel, said, wait, this doesn't make a lot of sense. And then in 2018, when Mark Harris was running, he went to hire the operative. His son emailed him to say, no, I believe that this man uses illegal methods. And then, of course, Mark Harris ended up hiring him anyway. And this was a big surprise to everyone. And Mark Harris had actually told people in his family, other people in his family, that he didn't think that those conversations with his son John would come up in the hearing. But then on the last day of the hearing, when Mark Harris was asked whether he anticipated that, he said he didn't remember talking about it to anybody. So it looked like Mark Harris had gotten himself into, you know, a little bit of legal trouble there by potentially not telling the truth on the stand. And in a dramatic moment at the end of the hearing, his testimony abruptly ended. He met with his lawyers, and then he came back, and the Washington Post reported that basically because of fears that Harris had lied on the stand, they negotiated a deal with the Democratic Council that Harris himself would call for a new election in exchange for being able to not continue testifying. And he's had a recent illness and strokes, and he said that he's been having trouble with memory loss.
Is that bullshit?
Which part, that he was having trouble with memory loss?
Yeah. This is Nate asking Nathaniel a question.
It's plausible. You know, he had been hospitalized for, I believe, a couple of weeks last month, and this was in the news. And he did say at this hearing that he had had a couple of strokes as a result of that, which we hadn't heard about before, but is plausible. And obviously, you know, a stroke is a serious thing and is an issue with the brain. So, you know, I'm not a medical professional, but
my understanding is that he made those comments about having the stroke. So his testimony was bifurcated. In the first part, he apparently made some misleading statements. There was a break in the testimony. And then when he came back, he read a statement saying, I've had some health problems. I might have been confused by some of the questions before. I think we need to have a new election. So it is a little bit like there was a break where maybe there was some consultation going on.
So,
who knows?
I mean, let me ask another real talk question. Is there a risk of him like being prosecuted for this, Mark Harris, or winding up with legal challenges of his own?
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, I'm not a lawyer or anything, but I would say yes. I think that the Democratic attorney, Mark Elias, who's this extremely prominent Democratic election lawyer, has continued to hammer Harris in the court of public opinion since the hearing concluded, saying that Harris had misleading testimony and complaining that he, Elias, did not get to cross-examine Harris after he abruptly left the stand. So Democrats definitely don't want to let Harris off the hook.
Before we get into what the plan is for the new election, Nate, Claire, Micah, how should what we've heard about in North Carolina shape our conception of how common election fraud is in America and what forms it takes?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think voter fraud and election fraud are, especially in this context, two very different things. This is not allegations of individual voters trying to cast a ballot twice or doing anything untoward. It's people who worked for Mark Harris's campaign trying to rig the election. And like, I think any language that's any more equivocal than that is misleading. They tried and maybe succeeded at rigging an election. By the way, they may also have rigged the Republican primary, which it's not clear they legitimately won in the first place or not.
Is this just a North Carolina's 9th congressional district issue? I mean, have we heard about not voter fraud, but election fraud in other places in the country?
I mean, a lot of election administration is very localized. And in
all
general,
of it is, actually.
Yeah, in general, it's thought of as a good thing because, like, number one, you can rig an election in one county or one congressional district, right? But it's harder to do it statewide if it's all decentralized, right? And number two, people are usually pretty good people who work in election systems and kind of care about it. So in some ways, you're kind of, like, exploiting informalities in the process that in a small rural county are probably common sense, quote unquote, right? And exploiting people's trust and exploiting procedures that make it easier for people to turn in various ways absentee ballots. I mean, again, that's why I go to like directly the question of like, should this guy be in jail or not? Because this really is a violation of trust of the American system. And like, this is really bad.
There's kind of mixed sentiment about whether or not our election system and how it's localized is good. I think elections officials would take Nate's stance, which is, yeah, we're all, because it's a balkanized system, if something goes wrong in one county, it won't necessarily spread. But on the other hand, we're leaving these elections in a time of cyber tampering, of just in general kind of, I think, maybe a little bit of a return of dirty tricks politics. We're leaving these really important things to offices that are well-intentioned but often underfunded and also sometimes just lack the skills or resources to know how to keep elections secure, even with their best intentions and best efforts. And so I think it is a little bit of a double-edged sword the way our elections are set up in these localized way. This is obviously, you know, it's a perversion of democracy to to do this to an election, but also I think people's bigger fears, if, when you look at it 30,000 feet up, is, well, what if this happens in a lot of different places, you know, in 2020, right? Like, what if someone else decides, like, oh, maybe you could replicate this other places?
I guess I did take heart from the fact that this was caught and relatively quickly, and it was relatively blatant.
And to know it was statistics that caught this.
Yeah.
Right? Well, that's the thing, is like, you know,
it's statistics. It's not like John Nash, like, standing at the whiteboard and, like, drawing complex equations, right?
No, it's just like,
this is really obvious. And you hear a lot of claims, you know, one thing working at Fire38, people will email you a lot of weird claims that, was this election rigged? And, like, it's extremely convoluted, usually, which is not to say it could never be true. But this is just like, what the hell is going on here? And you get that same, again, what the hell is going on here notion about, did this guy really win the Republican primary, Mark Harris, or not? Because there were big discrepancies in absentee ballots in that election, too. And that happened, what, in the spring last year? And although there were some kind of in-the-background investigations about it, it did not necessarily get caught.
But this is the equivalent of opening up the newspaper, you know, and seeing, oh, Steph Curry had 250 points last night. And you're like, something seems way off there. I don't know what to think of whether, like, you look at North Carolina 9, Nathaniel, I'd be curious for your thoughts, and you think, well, this is just the tip of the iceberg, or no, this got caught in our decentralized system with lots of eyes on it.
It's good.
It's good.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm naive, but I think that this is probably an isolated incident. I think, you know, it's true that this happened back in 2016, and we only kind of have started to pay attention to it here in 2018, potentially three elections after the 2016 election, then the two primaries this year after the fraud started. But it's important to note that locally, people have been all over this. So, you know, as I mentioned, John Harris noticed the fraud in the 2016 election. People for whom those results mattered dove into it, were aware of the fraud. There's been a criminal investigation going on in North Carolina into those 2016 results for basically that whole time. So, you know, nationally, you know, I think maybe we didn't pick up on it as quickly as we should have, but locally it has been caught, and it did seem to go through the proper channels. Maybe the only issue is that it wasn't resolved quickly enough.
So what does all of this mean for what comes next? What's the plan for the election redo? When is it going to happen, and who's going to run in the election?
We don't know a lot right now. So what we do know, we think, is that there's going to be both a new primary and a new general election. So typically, or at least before the law was recently changed, there was just going to be a new general election because the primary election was certified, the general election wasn't. But the North Carolina legislature changed the law in December, and that's probably because they didn't want Mark Harris to be their candidate in, you know, the legislature is Republican, and those Republicans didn't want Harris to be their candidate in the new election. But there is some indication that Democratic attorneys are going to challenge that law as kind of retroactively changing the law. So it's possible that we, you know, if there's a lawsuit and that gets overturned, then we might just be looking at a new general election. But for now, it's both a new primary and a new general election. So we're looking at probably October or November before there's another general election.
What's the baseline partisanship of the district? Can we say at this point who the favorite would be? I know that we don't know exactly who's going to be running in the general.
Yeah, exactly. The candidates, I think, are going to matter a lot, namely whether Harris runs and then wins the nomination. Obviously, I think he'd be an extremely damaged candidate. But overall, we know that the district it's a fairly Republican district. It is R plus 14, according to our partisan lean statistic. That said, it was one of the closest races in the 2018 election. I think it was actually the second or third closest race nationally.
Oh, yeah. We should mention that Mark Harris, you know, had apparently won by only 905 votes. You know,
I have a good idea of who should run.
Who?
John Harris.
The son.
Yeah.
Yep. I actually think that's not crazy. I think the Harris family is probably a little bit, you know, gun shy right now, but he looked really good in the hearing. He was kind of presented himself as, I'm a lawyer. I have to stick to my legal principles.
Like, good,
you know,
the
truth must come out. Yeah.
What if they run against one another? Wouldn't that be awesome?
But this is like the eternal question of, like, how far would you go to protect your family? In John Harris's case, not very.
Not my family committed election fraud.
Would you turn him in?
Yeah, hell yeah. So be careful, Silvers.
You guys don't.
Better not commit election fraud.
Toe the line, Silvers, or Nate's coming for you.
Nathaniel, it sounds like this is expected to be a close race again whenever it does happen, whoever ends up running.
Yeah, so the Cook Political Report has already issued a rating for this race. They've issued it a toss-up, which is the same as it was in the 2018 general election. Dan McCready, the Democratic candidate from 2018, who was a very, very strong candidate. He's a former Marine. He raised almost $7 million for the cycle. He has already said that he's running again. So, you know, if Republicans get a non-tainted candidate, you know, I think it'll be a very hard-fought race.
Nathaniel, we're going to leave it at that. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course, it was my pleasure.
And let's talk about the threat of a primary challenge to President Trump. But before we do that, today's podcast is brought to you by Casper Mattress. Want to upgrade your sleep game? Look no further than Casper, the sleep company with outrageously comfortable products at not so outrageous prices. Switching to Casper is a no-brainer. It's a high-quality mattress at an affordable price. You sleep cool and comfortable every night thanks to the unique combination of foams that provide you the right pressure relief and alignment. Casper ships right to your door for free in a small, how-do-they-even-do-that sized box. They'll even pick it up if you don't love it and refund you everything. From its engineering to its packaging to letting you try it for 100 nights, it's no wonder Casper has over 35,000 five-star reviews of all of their products across Casper, Google, and Amazon. Sleeping on a mattress is the best way to try it, so put Casper to the test in your own home for 100 nights risk-free. Go to casper.com/politics and use code POLITICS for $50 towards the purchase of select mattresses. That's casper.com/politics, code POLITICS, and get $50 towards the purchase of select mattresses. Terms and conditions apply. Additional fees may apply for Hawaii and Alaska.
Casper has more five-star reviews than this podcast has ratings.
So fix that, people.
Yeah.
We have 10,230 five-star ratings on iTunes.
You really love us. You'll give us a review.
Listeners?
That must mean that Casper's pretty good.
It does mean that, but it also means our listeners have failed us.
All right. Today's podcast is also brought to you by SimpliSafe. No one should feel unsafe at home, period. That's been SimpliSafe's mission from day one. You may have seen their commercial about it during the big game this year. That's the Super Bowl. If you didn't, you can find it online. SimpliSafe blankets your whole home with protection. Around-the-clock professional monitoring makes sure police are on the way when you need them. The security sensors are tiny, blending in with your home so you don't notice them. The Verge calls SimpliSafe the best home security, and it's a wire-cutter top pick. As more than 3 million SimpliSafe customers already know, it feels good to fear less. So protect your home today. You'll get free shipping on any system order. Just visit simplisafe.com/politics. That's simplisafe.com/politics to protect your home and family today. simplisafe.com/politics. All right. Former governor of Massachusetts Bill Weld announced his exploratory committee earlier this month for a Republican primary campaign. I know, you guys, does this call for music? It's just an exploratory committee.
Yeah, it calls for
music.
Yeah,
it's the same. Play that.
All right, here we go. As I already mentioned, former governor of Massachusetts, Bill Weld, has an exploratory committee, and he's considering running for president in the Republican primary. So what we want to talk about is a little bit about who Bill Weld is, but more than that, kind of what effect he could have, what effect primary challengers against incumbent presidents have in general, and what Trump should actually worry about. So let's begin with the basics. Claire, who is Bill Weld and what is his line of attack against the president?
Definitely a who.
Bill Weld is definitely a who. He is a former governor of Massachusetts and a blonde man, which I just feel is notable because it's sort of like this distinctive look. I think you see this a lot coming out of Massachusetts, which is a pretty liberal state, but they tend to kind of have this balance thing going on where they'll often elect Republican governors. And Bill Weld is one of those people, kind of a traditional New England Republican. If you put him on a partisanship square, he sort of ends up as a left-leaning libertarian, a little bit more socially progressive libertarian. And he, in fact, ran with Gary Johnson in 2016 as Johnson's vice presidential candidate on the Libertarian ticket. He actually left the Republican Party in order to run with Gary Johnson. And I think Bill Weld's proposition is basically, in some ways, honestly, similar to Howard Schultz, which is sort of the idea that, listen, there are still some people, some moderates out there who kind of want a straight-shooting, responsible adult who has some of their fiscal interests in common, and that's going to kind of be his vibe. I want to read this quote from Bill Weld at the 2016 Libertarian Convention just to give people sort of a flavor of him.
Go for it.
This is from a story I wrote about Gary Johnson at the Libertarian Convention. And someone asked Bill Weld about the CIA's involvement in the Middle East. I don't know why. They just did. And Weld answered by saying, quote, "It was my great uncle-in-law, Kermit Roosevelt, who in 1953 came out of Groton and Harvard with a little walking around money in his pockets and engineered the Mossadegh overthrow in Iran. So maybe I'm a bad person to ask." And I think that just...
There's a lot there.
I mean, Bill Weld is a patrician, old-school Republican running in the Tea Party, yeah, activist, modern Republican Party. And that is, I would probably say, not a winning proposition, but an interesting one.
Well, it's interesting and raises a question of, okay, if you are a Republican who wants to challenge Trump, are you better off going after his strength or his weakness? Weld is going after his weakness, right? Trump doesn't have a lot of appeal with these more educated, more moderate New England Republicans. Now, there aren't a lot of those Republicans left. While Trump is super strong among the groups Claire was mentioning, kind of your modern Republican Party, more Southern-based, more conservative, I don't know what the answer to that question is.
Bill Weld, to me, appeals to a group of people, moderate Republicans, possibly college-educated Republicans, who are basically functioning as Democrats now on a national level, right? Like, those are the people who voted for Democratic candidates in 2018 to the House. Those are the people that were Romney-Clinton voters in 2016. To me, that's kind of Weld's demographic, and I wonder, okay, so maybe you can win back a few of those people, but does that win you the Republican primary? No.
It doesn't win you the primary, but like...
It weakens Trump, which is maybe his whole point.
In some spots, maybe. Like in open primaries, let's say New Hampshire has an open primary, right? In New Hampshire, and remember, Weld is from a neighbor, Weld could actually do pretty well. There's a lot of... First of all, New Hampshire's Republican Party overall is sort of more in his image, although not really. Still probably closer to Trump than Weld. But, you know, independents can vote in the Republican primary. And so if there are conservative-leaning voters in New Hampshire who want to be able to register disapproval of Trump, now they have a way to do it in Weld. Now, that probably means he gets, like, I think a good showing for him would be 30% of the vote in New Hampshire, maybe. I don't know, something like that, 40%. That would register a weakness on Trump's part. But is he going to win? No.
So to answer your question about which would do more damage, attacking President Trump's strengths or weaknesses, I was looking at a bunch of polling yesterday for the game that we're going to play next. And actually, when they obviously he has no intention of running for president, but when they polled Cruz versus Trump in a primary versus Kasich versus Trump in a primary, Cruz does significantly better than Kasich. So Cruz isn't exactly a Trump Republican. He's probably more squarely Tea Party than Trump is. But that seems to be more attacking Trump based on his strength than attacking Trump based on his weakness. And Cruz is the one who does better.
Yeah, and I guess that makes sense. You know, there have been these polls floating around, which I don't know how meaningful they are, but you hear a lot about how Trump has a, whatever, 90% approval rating in the Republican Party. But then when you ask Republicans, do you want to reelect, you know, renominate Trump, or would you like to vote someone else? I think it's like anywhere from about a third to 4 in 10 say they would like to vote for someone else.
Well, I hate the someone else, you know, generic candidate has won every election for president since, you know, 1793 or whatever.
I mean, Nate's right that like a generic candidate is always going to beat a specific candidate because, you know, you kind of imagine whoever you want to imagine. But it's still a reflection, I think, of weakness on Trump's part.
So is it fair to say that Bill Weld, if he runs for president, would be a serious primary challenger? And perhaps first we should define what a serious primary challenger would be. I don't mean win, but maybe more cause possibly existential problems for Trump.
Larry Hogan is another interesting potential Trump primary challenger. John Kasich, I guess, is another potential Trump primary challenger. Hogan and Kasich, to me, are more viable than Weld because they've been governors either now or very recently. And I do think that matters. I think Weld is a little bit out of step And Hogan has the good fortune of being a very popular governor. Kasich has run for president before, has some pretty socially conservative bona fides. To me, they have a more natural constituency. Not that I think they're both who's, but Weld is more of a who.
Yes, I think that's right. Weld also, I wouldn't go this far, but Weld also has like a whiff of the kind of perennial candidate going about him, right, where he's, you know, he ran as a libertarian, blah, blah, blah. But let's, to Galen's point about, it's very, very unlikely that any of these people could beat Trump. So let's use from Jeffrey Skelly, one of our writers, published a piece today that laid out five levels for a Republican challenger. Again, because we need a way to talk about, well, how much noise basically can this person create? So level one is, who's that? Basically, incumbents always get challenged. You never hear of them. That's that group. Level two, you make a splash. This is like Pat Buchanan in 1992. You don't win any states, but you get a meaningful share of the vote. You get a speaking slot at the convention. There are some stories written about the direction of the party, et cetera, et cetera. Level three, nominee could be in trouble. So think Ted Kennedy in 1980, who didn't beat Jimmy Carter, but won some states and ultimately kind of stole the show at the convention with that The Dream Shall Never Die speech. Level four, danger. Think Reagan in 1976. He almost beat Gerald Ford and went to the convention. Neither had a majority of delegates. And then level five, which we've never had, is the incumbent is defeated. So I think Weld is probably somewhere in between level one and level two. While to Claire's point, Hogan or Kasich maybe could get between two and three, maybe?
They seem Buchanan.
Closer to two?
Here's my thing. I once talked to this guy, these guys who are trying to figure out like which startup succeeded, and they want to try and be like the money ball of startups. So they just use, you know, metrics, right? And I said the best metric was, what is someone willing to give up to found this startup? If it literally is some guy or girl in a garage who is just kind of, you know, smoking weed and playing PlayStation, and they have a startup, it might be a good startup. Some startups succeed that way, but they're not really like sacrificing a lot to make that work, right? If they step down from like their position as a senior developer at Apple or something, right, to found the startup, then that means that they're investing more, they're making more of a risk. So to me, it's like, which Republican candidate so far is actually making any risk or sacrifice to run for the nomination? And Bill Weld, who was a at one point kind of reputed as like a good moderate governor, right, is someone who's been out of the spotlight for a long time. He was a libertarian VP nominee and actually almost didn't win that because there were people who thought he wasn't libertarian enough. Not someone who's at kind of the forefront of political conversation. And so I don't know, right?
Is Larry Hogan closest to that? I mean, he's the current governor of Maryland. He could probably make people angry in his state, potentially.
Larry Hogan is the current, one of the more popular, maybe the most popular, along with Charlie Baker, governors in the country.
But would he be taking the biggest risk, looking at your way of assessing what people are willing to give up?
No, because Hogan's been elected twice, so he can't run a third time. He could get nominated some cabinet position in like a moderate Republican president's administration or a Democratic one, right? If they went to the Obama thing and let's pick a couple of Republicans, and Hogan could be a guy that was nominated to some or another position, you would think. Maybe he could run for Senate. It's hard to win in a blue state like Maryland a federal office. People feel differently about statewide and federal offices. And frankly, if he does, then being an anti-Trump Republican in a very blue state might be better for him. So he has like more stature, and he would be kind of sacrificing some of that stature to run against Trump, but he's not like really taking that much of a political risk, right?
Yeah, I think you're not giving him quite
okay,
enough
credit. Okay, well, relative to Bill Weld, sure.
Right. I mean,
he is a current governor in a medium-sized state.
And he's in a party in which challenging the incumbent president who's very popular in that party. I mean, I take your point about he's in a blue state and et cetera, but still, it there's some risk there.
Okay, so Micah, in the levels that you laid out for us, level five, somebody actually winning the Republican primary who is not Donald Trump seems extremely, extremely unlikely. But let's talk about the significance of the other scenarios happening, right? One through four. What do we know about the effects of a primary challenger on an incumbent's likelihood of winning re-election in the general.
The track record of when you have a serious primary challenge is that you lose a general election. Carter lost general election in 1980. Ford lost in 1976. Democrats lost in 68, which arguably was a successful primary challenge, where LBJ did disappointingly in New Hampshire, right? 92, Bush versus Buchanan. So the track record is pretty bad. But it's also a different paradigm now where, like, Trump's approval rating is like 85% among Republicans, 85, 88, whatever, and like really awful among everyone else. And so as these things become more and more polar and partisan, there's also some evidence, it's probably a fairly weak effect. There's a little bit of an effect where if you were a Republican and you don't like Trump, you may no longer call yourself a Republican, so that can affect the polls too. But look, there's no doubt that like in a sample size of 4 or 5 cases, that it's a really negative indicator. On the other hand, it's a bit like if you just run to undermine Trump to play up that indicator, it's, I don't know. I think it's like the reason why Trump is in trouble potentially for 2020 is that Trump is quite unpopular. The consequence of that is that he might be unpopular enough to trigger a primary challenge, but I don't think it's the cause.
Yeah.
A bad Mueller report could maybe juice up some of these primary challenges.
I think that's totally right. I think the way to look at all this is as a barometer of Trump's support overall and in the party. And if the Mueller report comes out and vindicates Trump in some way, then I think you'll see a lot of this go away. And if it's really harmful, I think you'll see a lot of it heat up. But even, you know, even look at like Obama, what was it? Obama in 2012, I don't think got a serious primary challenge. But in Arkansas, another candidate won 42% of the vote there, which...
In the Democratic primary.
In the Democratic primary. So in other words, he didn't beat Obama, but he did pretty well. And I think that was a reflection of Obama's weakness among white conservative voters, a weakness which persisted with the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton 2016 and blah, 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 blah. So like, I don't think the real question is will Trump get beaten? It's more like, what can we learn about the nature of Trump's support and strength going into the general election, given how these voters vote in the primary?
All right. So, Claire, what indicators then would you say in a potential Republican primary would spell trouble for Trump? Like, who would have to run? How much of a percentage would they get? Where would they do well?
I think maybe a 92 year in general, where the electorate has an appetite for someone different than the party's major candidate. So I think it's approval ratings. It's probably Trump's approval ratings. That's something to keep an eye on. Like I said before, I think if the Mueller report is damning, if, you know, let's say the Southern District of New York continues, you know, is looking into criminal activities, like if that stuff continues, I think that's probably a bad indicator for Trump. I think if any of his challengers get substantial fundraising hauls, that's an indicator that Trump has a problem. Those are kind of the big ones. I mean, a lot of this, I think, has to do with it's February, it's late February. We basically have a year until the first primaries. A lot of stuff could happen in the next year that weakens the position of the president.
If he's winning less than, let's say, this is total ballpark, but let's say if he's winning less than 75-70% of the vote in these primaries, then I'd say pay a little attention.
Isn't this some stupid media expectations game, though, right?
No. We're just ballparking out what could go wrong.
Someone like William Webb running this token bid to unseat Donald Trump.
I think that's
Trump.
Too dismissive.
Yeah, I'm asking more.
I think
more,
it's not dismissive enough, in fact.
Okay, but can we talk more about a hypothetical? Like, if we're going to talk about a possible Republican primary challenger, at what point should Trump be worried? Obviously, we've answered that the answer is not Bill Weld.
At a point, an order or two of magnitude beyond the threat that William Webb presents.
If Hogan gets in?
No.
If Nikki Haley gets in?
Yes.
Maybe that's the line.
The Haley line.
The Haley line.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we'll leave it at that then. And now it's time for a game. So we are going to play a round of Guess What Americans Think. But let me say first that today's podcast is brought to you by Quip. One of the most important things we can do for our health every day is brushing our teeth. Yet most of us don't do it properly. Quip is a better electric toothbrush created by dentists and designers. A built-in 2-minute timer pulses every 30 seconds to remind you when to switch sides, helping guide a full and even clean. Up to 90% of us don't brush for a full 2 minutes or don't clean evenly. Plus, its multi-use cover mounts to your mirror and unmounts to slide over your bristles for on-the-go brushing. It declutters your sink or cabinet and makes traveling with an electric toothbrush easier. Quip doesn't require a clunky charger and runs for 3 months on just one charge. All this is why they're backed by over 20,000 dental professionals. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/538 right now, you get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electronic toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip, getquip.com/538. It's time for Guess What Americans Think. It's a wild and crazy world of early primary polling out there. So we're going to see how well you've either been paying attention or just how well you intuitively know what Americans think. And the way this works, we've played this a couple times before, is I'm going to give you a polling question and you're going to guess how Americans answered. Not all of these are numerical answers, but a lot of them are. And if it is numerical, whoever gets closest wins. Otherwise, sometimes it will be the name of a candidate or something like that.
No Googling.
No Googling, right. All right.
Nate.
Number one, Nate, we're going to start with you, and then we'll rotate. What percent of Republicans in South Carolina would vote for Nikki Haley if she were to primary Trump?
Who's the pollster?
Change Research.
Can you use the poll in a sentence, please?
Answer the question.
26.
Nate's got 26% of Republicans in South Carolina would vote for the former governor of the state, Nikki Haley, if she were to primary Trump. Claire.
15.
15. Micah?
27.
We're doing the Price is Right thing already?
So the answer is 21%, and that means that, Nate, you take it, right?
Wait, what did Claire say?
15.
Yeah.
Woo. Yeah, Nate's one closer.
Wait,
one
what did he closer. Say?
He said 26.
And so Nate's 15. 5 off, you're 6 off, I'm 7 off.
And that's according to Change Research.
If you average the 3 guesses, by the way, this proves the wisdom of betting markets.
And for some context there, Flake, Corker, Weld, and Kasich all polled at either 2 or 3%. So maybe this gets
the
to
Haley line.
Our comment earlier about Nikki Haley being the line for when things get serious. All right, here's number two. So Nate has one. Claire, number two, you're up first. For Democratic primary voters who choose Bernie Sanders as their first choice, who is their most common second choice?
I want to say Warren, but I feel like it's not.
Go for it. Pick something.
Fine. Warren.
Warren. Micah.
Biden.
All right. Biden. Nate.
I think the answer is Biden.
Is that your guess,
though? You can't copy me.
Well, it's not a number.
Can I confess to a little bit of cheating here? We have a story in the works that gets at this, and I don't know the exact number, but the thesis of the story would suggest Biden.
Okay. And the answer is Biden. So this is according to Morning Consult. For people who chose Bernie Sanders as their first choice, 26% chose Biden as their second, 16% chose Warren as their second, 6% chose Beto as their second. And the same is true for people who pick Biden as their first choice. Sanders is the most common second. So that means that Nate has 2, Claire 0, Micah 1.
What's interesting there, by the way, is, and this is what our story is going to talk about, at least right now, if you look at like first choice, second choice, there's not a lot of evidence of lanes or anything like that. So like Claire, I think, ultimately will be right that Bernie and Warren voters will see a lot of overlap there. But right now, it's sort of just name recognition.
On to question number 3. Micah, you're going to start with this. What percent of Americans have never heard of Howard Schultz?
I am going to say, when was the question asked?
The poll was released on February 13th.
Okay, I'm going to say 67%.
67%? Nate?
Who's the pollster?
Fox News.
58%. I've never heard of him.
Claire?
88.
Guys, underestimating how well-known Howard Schultz is, only 36% of Americans said they had never heard of Howard Schultz.
Wow.
Wow.
And among those who do know who he is, he's underwater at a negative 13 net approval rating. So who's closest?
Nate said 50-something, right?
Yeah, I was the lowest.
Oh, Nate's there you go. Yes. Yeah. So it's 3-0-1. on to the fourth question. Nate, we're starting with you again. The question is, what percent of Americans said that a candidate's support for the Green New Deal would make them less likely to vote for that candidate?
Okay, I really need to know the pollster for this.
Emerson.
Would make them less likely.
Can you please give me the exact question?
This is what I have for you. When asked if a presidential candidate supporting the Green New Deal would affect their vote, they said, more likely, less likely, unsure.
24%.
Claire?
30.
Micah?
31.
Micah's stealing it from Claire. It is 39% said that would make them less likely.
Such a jackass.
Trying to keep Claire shut out here.
Yeah, I do have a streak going.
So what is it? It's 4-0. Do you have two or three, Micah?
He has two.
Two. Okay.
Know thine enemy.
We are on to the next question, starting with Claire. This is kind of a tricky one. Today is the 768th day of Trump's presidency. Going back to 1945, Trump has a higher approval rating than two presidents on their 767th day. Who are they?
LBJ and Nixon? No.
Wait, how far are we going back?
To 1945 when Gallup started tracking.
This is according to Gallup, not our tracker?
We were not averaging approval ratings in 1945.
Jimmy Carter and LBJ. I don't know.
Jimmy Carter, LBJ. This is a two-point question, of course. Micah, you're up next.
So you're looking for presidents who had a shitty first midterm. Didn't Reagan have a shitty first midterm?
I'm not helping you.
You just got to guess.
Reagan and Ford.
Nate?
I'm going to go with William Henry Harrison because he was dead, man. It's not very popular. I'm going to go with Reagan and Carter.
All right. And Nate gets 2 points. Claire gets 1 point.
Yay.
Micah, you get 0 points.
Yay.
What are you talking about? I said Reagan and Ford.
Oh, you get 1 point. Sorry. Trump's approval rating is 42.7%. Reagan's approval rating was 35.3%. Carter's was 42.5%. So it's 6-1-3 with Nate in the lead.
Oh, man. Ford's approval rating was 0.9 points above Trump's. Let's do one question, winner take all.
Okay. All right. All right. Micah says we got one more question. Winner take all starting.
Wait, what?
No, you missed your chance to object.
We can do Final Jeopardy where you can bet how many points on the answer. That's good. That's
sure.
Strategic.
How many are you betting on the last one?
Well, it's all secret. We have to write it down.
No, okay. Well, we're not doing it.
We can slack you.
So
here, let's slack Galen.
Okay. All right. You guys have all bet. This is a special final round question. This is according to Emerson polling. Micah, you are first. What percent of Americans said they had a good Valentine's Day?
What the f***?
110%.
I'm going to say...
69%.
I'm going to say 57%, Galen.
57%. Okay, Nate?
Nate already gave his guess.
69%.
All right, Claire?
72%.
And Claire wins it. It
was, hell yeah!
87% of Americans said they had a good Valentine's
country.
Day.
Okay,
people are full of shit. There's no way 82% of Americans had a good Valentine's 87%. Day. 87%. Okay, that's bull.
That is the most agreeable Americans are, I think, in this Emerson poll. They didn't agree on anything more.
Does anybody
than that they had a good Valentine's Day?
Believe. Oh, we have to reveal the how many people bet.
Oh, yes. Okay, how many points? So Nate Silver bet 0 points. Micah bet 52 points.
You can't do that, man.
Claire bet 100 points. That
Claire
means
wins. Yeah.
We never said, I guess, that you can only bet how many points
exactly.
You have.
Exactly, and that's right. Why I did that.
So, Micah, you're in point debt now.
I owe points for the next game.
Yes, you'll start the next round of
Wait,
Guess What
87%
Americans.
87% of
Americans. So wow. They had a good Valentine's
Day.
That's
such bullshit.
It's Why? Also kind of great. They didn't allow responders to this poll to say that they didn't know. They were forced to pick. So See. That means only 13% said they had a bad Valentine's
How many
Day.
People have dates on Valentine's Day?
Oh, as if Micah, to assume that you have to have a date on Valentine's Day to have a good Valentine's Day.
Did you guys ever know the blog Sad
kind
Single
of.
Girl Searches?
No.
One of them
was, I swear to God, Nate Silver single question mark
Okay. Stop it.
And I think Micah's how many people have dates on Valentine's Day is one of them.
All right. I think that marks the end of the show. Nate, thank you so much for playing Guess What Americans Think. We need to get music, right?
This is one of our best or our worst shows.
We'll leave it up to the listeners to decide. It's going to be
heavily edited, yeah.
Claire, thank you.
Thank you.
Gail. Micah, thank you.
You're welcome.
And before we go, we'll just say one more time that we do have a live show in New York on March 20th. If you want to get tickets, learn more details about that show, like what time it is, 538.com/live. We will see you there. That's it for us. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Real friends tell their friends to listen to the 538 Politics Podcast. Isn't that true, guys?
Yeah, I mean, again, and remember, this episode is not necessarily representative of the larger body of 538, a 538 podcast.
Pretty representative, though.
All right. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.